you begin a series of burdens. In the book of Isaiah, there again, if you check out the numbering of the word burden, you'll find out it's a significant number as well. I haven't counted them all up, but the book of Lamentations or Habakkuk, there are a lot of burdens mentioned in the Scriptures. And of course, that just means bad news or calamity coming. So if I were marking this chapter, I'd use the topic pencil and just circle Burden of Babylon. And then you know what this chapter is all about. The Burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos did see, lift you up a banner upon the high mountain. Exalt the voice unto them, shake the hand, that they may go into the gates of the nobles. Now you'll find the same type thing, Jeremiah 51, verse 25, showing again the unity and harmony of the prophets. Jeremiah 51, verse 25, verse 24 shows he's also talking about Babylon. I'll render unto Babylon and to all the inhabitants of Chaldea all their evil that they've done in Zion, in your sight, says the Eternal. Behold, I'm against you, O destroying mountain, says the Eternal, which destroys all the earth. And I'll stretch out my hand upon you and roll you down from the rocks and will make you a burnt mountain. So here again, in the same language, with the same symbols, he's talking about Babylon, just like Isaiah did. The same thing is in Jeremiah chapter 50. The words of the Eternal spake against Babylon and against the land of the Chaldeans by Jeremiah the prophet. Declare you among the nations and publish and set up a standard. Publish, conceal not. Say, Babylon is taken. Baal is confounded. Of course, that's the name for the sun god, Baal or Bel in Chaldean. And that's how they changed the men's names. You know, when you remember the names of the men in Daniel, don't remember their pagan names, their Babylonian names. That's the ones we sing about, you know. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They changed their names. They were named after God before. You know, these men in the Bible, almost all of them were named after God. If their name ended in A-H or E-L, they were named after God. So they just changed their names and named them after their God. Belteshazzar, you know, or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they named them after their gods. Well, what were their names before? Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They were all named after God. But they changed their names and named it after Baal and their other gods. So when Babylon is taken, their pagan religion is going to fall too. So notice, along with the captivity in the future, the destruction of Babylon, declare you among the nations, notice that's plural, Babylon isn't going to just be one nation in the last days. It's going to be a combine of nations. Babylon is taken, Baal is confounded, Merodach is broken in pieces. Her idols are confounded, her images are broken in pieces. So in the future fall of Babylon, their religion's also going to be obliterated off the face of the earth. And that hadn't happened in the past. Then he says where it's coming from in verse 3. For out of the north. And of course, biblically, that's talking about the Medes and the Persians coming in on the Babylonian Empire in Belshazzar's day and bringing it down. And again in the future, the power that's going to destroy Babylon is going to be the same. That same Asiatic, Media-Persian, Gog and Magog combine of nations. Out of the north there comes up a nation against her that's going to make her land desolate, and none's going to dwell therein. So even Babylon's going to be desolate the first part of the millennium. They'll remove, they'll depart, both man and beast. And you might notice the context in verse 4. At the time Babylon is brought down and their religion destroyed by the Media-Persian power, in the old days. In the future, it says, verse 4, in those days and in that time, says the Eternal, the children of Israel shall come, they and the children of Judah together. So there's still two separate families, two separate children. They're not all in one and the same. So at the time this happens to Babylon, Israel and Judah still are separate peoples and separate nations. They're going to come together, going and weeping. They'll go and seek the eternal their God. They'll ask the way to Zion, that's God's capital hill, with their faces thitherward. Come, let's join ourselves to the eternal in a perpetual covenant that shall not be forgotten. So then the new covenant will be made with the children of Israel and the children of Judah. But it's after Babylon falls, and that battle takes place with those Media-Persian powers. Now back to Isaiah 13. Lift up a banner on the high mountain, exalt the voice to them, shake the hand, that they may go into the gates of the nobles. Now he says, I have commanded my sanctified one. You might notice in chapter 44 and verse 28, chapter 44, verse 28, that says, the Tyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasures, even saying to Jerusalem, you'll be built, and to the temple your foundation shall be laid. Thus says the Eternal to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him. But plainly God shows when he takes a ruler or a power to use in punishing someone else, that's what they're anointed for. They're sanctified. They're set apart for that specific purpose by God. So God speaks to Cyrus as his anointed. And he went so far as to say exactly what he'd say to Jerusalem about rebuilding the temple and the foundation. So that's the same thing he's saying here. When God is going to bring down Babylon, then he's commanded my sanctified one. Notice the power that brings down Babylon is a group of nations. Not just one man like Cyrus or one empire, but my sanctified one. I have also called my mighty one for mine anger. Now this thing, the Greek word there, mighty one, is the same word as heroes. You might notice Joel chapter 3, beginning verse 9. Here we are, verse 14, multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the eternal is near in the valley of decision. So at the time when Armageddon takes place, you have all the Asiatic hordes meeting with the European nations, ready to have the last battle to decide who's going to dominate the world. Of course, the nations of Europe are promised by their religious leader that they'll be used of God to put an end to these heathen, pagans, and set up a millennium. And yet, the Orientals are going to be assured that they're finally going to put an end to this superstitious Christianity of the Western powers. So there are multitudes, multitudes, 200 million in one army and how many in the other. In the Valley of Decision, when the day of the Eternal takes place, the sun and the moon have already been darkened and the stars have already withdrawn their shining. And that's when, verse 16, the Eternal is going to roar out of Zion. So apparently that shows he comes back first and gathers his elect and they're changed to spirit beings and they go with him to punish these world powers and to regather Israel, the captives. Because it says the Eternal shall roar out of Zion, not down from heaven, but out of Zion, and utter his voice from Jerusalem. And the heavens and the earth will shake. But the Eternal is going to be the hope of his people. But back up to verse 9, here God is getting these world powers ready for this meeting at Armageddon. And he says, verse 9, proclaim you this among the Gentiles, prepare war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords. So instead of a time of peace, every power is getting ready for this last battle of man on the earth to see who's going to finally conquer the world. So they're beating plowshares into swords and pruning hooks into spears. And even little bitty countries like Arabia and Iran and Iraq, let the weak say, I am strong. People of India, or who all else is going to have atomic weapons by then? So at that time, God says, there are going to be countries in the past we've considered weak. And yet, he says, let the weak say, I am strong. Assemble yourselves and come, all you heathen, Asiatic hordes, European nation, all you heathen, assemble yourselves and come. Gather yourselves together round about. Thither cause your mighty ones to come down, O Eternal. So then God is going to intervene with the armies of heaven and all the saints born of God. Let the heathen be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, because there I'm going to sit to judge all the heathen round about. And this is the time of harvest. Verse 13 is very plainly shown in Revelation 14 and verse 15. When does that harvest take place? When God puts his sickle into the earth to reap the harvest of the final nations gathered at Armageddon. Put you in the sickle because the harvest is ripe. In other words, you've got to intervene now or else. If you don't intervene now, then the harvest is going to overripe and rot, and it'll be worthless. So you have to put in the sickle because the harvest is ripe. Come, get you down, for the press is full, the vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. In other words, God, if you don't rip open the heavens and get you down and come, it's going to be too late. The press is full, the vats overflow, multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. So there, God's mighty ones are referred to as the spirit beings that are going to intervene with God. Back here in Isaiah 13, his sanctified ones, his mighty ones, you'll see a little later, actually, the Asiatic horde, the leaders of Gog and Magog, the leaders of Media Persia, they're the ones God has set apart for this final punishment of Babylon. For mine anger, even them that rejoice in my highness, the noise of a multitude in the mountains, like as of a great people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. So just like we read there in Joel, here you have all the final armies of the Asiatic hordes gathered against the nations of Europe, a multitude in the mountains, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations. In other words, all the kingdoms of the heathen all gathered together. The Eternal of Hosts musters the host of the battle. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven. In other words, as far east as you can go, these Japanese and Russians and Asiatic hordes. And the Eternal is going to come at the same time, the weapons of his indignation, to destroy the whole land. Then he says, howl you, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It'll come as a destruction from the Almighty. So, more technically, the day of the Lord is the time when God intervenes and starts pouring out trumpet plagues on these Asiatic and European powers before they annihilate human life off the earth. So that's a good verse to show you what the day of the Lord is. It's a destruction from the Almighty. And it's a time of trouble and howling. You might, when you look up the term, the day of the Lord, it's kind of interesting the places where it appears, because we've read it here in Isaiah 13, it's back in Ezekiel 13 and verse 5, and then all of the other places are in the minor prophets. That makes you wonder that the minor prophets are more exactly, totally, for the last days. You know, in the minor prophets, you don't have all that history of the old time and the physical fulfillment back in that day and the armies or the kings. In the minor prophets, it's almost 100% for the end time. That's something. Out of 16 times the day of the Lord is mentioned, that term exactly, only twice outside the minor prophets. 14 times in the minor prophets. Going on here anyway, in Ezekiel chapter 30, you might jot down a parallel to this. Ezekiel chapter 30, verse 1, the word of the Eternal came, Son of man, prophesy, howl you. Woe worth the day. So almost exactly for word what Isaiah said, Ezekiel says, and it's all about the same time as you read on. Howl you. Woe worth the day, for the day is near, even the day of the Eternal is near. A cloudy day. It'll be the time of the heathen. So you see what the day of the Lord is. it's the day of the destruction from the Almighty on all these heathens. It's going to be a cloudy day, the time of the heathens. The sword shall come up upon Egypt. Great pain shall be in Ethiopia. Verse 5, Ethiopia, Libya, Lydia, all the mingled people, the men of the land that's in league, fall with them by the sword. Well, back to Isaiah once again. One scripture that parallels in the minor prophets, you might jot down Zephaniah chapter 1 and verse 7. Hold your peace at the presence of the Lord Eternal, for the day of the Eternal is at hand, for the Eternal has prepared a sacrifice, he has bid his gift. So God gets these nations before they destroy the earth together at Armageddon, and God is going to prepare a sacrifice by getting these guests together and putting an end to human government. It'll come to pass, in the day of the Eternal sacrifice, I'll punish the princes and the king's children, and all such as are clothed with strange apparel. That's Zephaniah 1, verses 7 and 8. Okay, coming back to Isaiah, the day of the Eternal's at hand is going to come as a destruction. Therefore, shall all hands be faint, and every man's heart shall melt. Now, you might want to jot down Luke 21 and verse 26, because Christ took that scripture and tied it in a sequence leading up to the end in his day. Luke 21, 26, there will be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars. Upon the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things that are coming on the earth, because the powers of heaven shall be shaken. Every man's heart shall melt. He took that right out of Isaiah 13, where we're reading here. Okay, back to Isaiah anyway. They shall be afraid, pangs and sorrow shall take hold of them. They'll be in pain as a woman that travaileth. They'll be amazed one at another. Their faces will be as flames. In other words, terrified and affrighted, and just fiery looks in their faces of horror. Behold, the day of the Eternal comes, cruel both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he'll destroy the sinners thereof out of it. Or, as Revelation says, God will destroy the destroyers. So he puts a halt to man annihilating life off the earth and blowing it to bits. For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. And, of course, Christ used that in Matthew 24:29. We've read it already in the account of Luke. The stars of heaven shall not give their light. The sun will be darkened. Is that from just a man's life of smog and destruction and smoke and all of the things that are destroying the atmosphere? I'll punish the world for their evil and the wicked for their iniquity. And I'll cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease. I'll lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. I'll make a man more precious than fine gold. In other words, that's how few people there are left after all this takes place. In verse 11, where he says, I'll punish the world, the Hebrew word is tabel, which means the habitable part. It doesn't mean the globe. It doesn't mean the orb. It just means the cosmos on the globe. And here again, he draws attention to the various stages of degeneracy in man. He uses different words for sin. The wicked, literally the word lawless, for their iniquity. In this case, the word iniquity is the word, the sin of your nature, the vanity of your traits of character. I'll cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease, and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. The word evil is the word rea, which means the missing of the mark. So here God again draws attention to the various areas of sin. I'll make a man more precious than fine gold, even a man than the golden wedge of Ophir. Therefore, I'll shake the heavens, and the earth shall remove out of her place. Now, keep your finger there and notice Haggai 2, back in the Minor Prophets. Right after Zephaniah, before Zechariah. Haggai chapter 2, verse 6, "For thus says the Eternal Host, yet once, it's a little while, and I'll shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I'll shake all nations." And when is all that going to happen? Well, right before Christ's second coming, or along with his second coming. "I'll shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come, and I'll fill this house with glory." But when Christ comes back and establishes world headquarters again in Jerusalem and fills God's house with glory once again, but right before that, God's going to shake all nations, and he's going to shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, just like we read back here in Isaiah 13. "I'll shake the heavens and the earth, shall remove out of her place in the wrath of the Eternal Host." So there again, the term shows it's the day of the Lord, the wrath of the Eternal, the destruction from the Almighty in the day of his fierce anger. "It'll be as the chased roe and as the sheep that no man takes up." In other words, people are so scarce and scattered from the fright of the things that are going on in the world. "They shall every man turn to his own people and flee everyone into his own land. Everyone that's found shall be thrust through." So when those armies all gathered at Armageddon finally meet the superpower of God and the armies of heaven, they're going to be panic-stricken and fleeing back every man to his own people. And there again it shows that it's a multitude of countries gathered together. "Everyone that's found shall be thrust through. Everyone that's joined to them shall fall by the sword." So God is going to totally put an end to all the people bent on destruction and war and fighting, and their children also shall be dashed to pieces before their eyes. And this is talking about what the Assyrians or Babylonians did to other nations, then these Asiatics are going to do to them. So you can look up other scriptures showing that's what happened, that's what they did. Notice the book of Nahum, chapter 3. Nahum, chapter 3, and verse 10, verse 7. "It'll come to pass, all they that look upon you shall flee from you and say, Nineveh is laid waste. Who will bemoan her? Whence shall I seek comforter for you? Are you better than populous No, that was situate among the rivers, that had the waters round about it, whose rampart was the sea, and her wall was from the sea? Ethiopia and Egypt were her strength. It was infinite. But Lubim were thy helpers. Yet she was carried away. She went into captivity. Her young children also were dashed in pieces at the top of all the streets, and they cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound in chains. So just as Babylon had done to the powers of Israel and the nations of Judah, around Judah, then that's going to happen to them. And apparently at the time they're going to be in some kind of a treaty with Ethiopia and Egypt and the countries around Arabia and North Africa. You might jot down Zechariah chapter 14, because it just shows you how these prophecies all tie in exactly together. "Behold, the day of the Eternal comes. Your spoil shall be divided in the midst of you. I'll gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. The city will be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished. Half the city will go forth into captivity. The residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then shall the Eternal go forth and fight against those nations, as when he fought in the day of battle, and his feet shall stand in that day on the Mount of Olives. And it splits, and the living waters start going out." And as we read back in Isaiah, verse 5, "You'll flee to the valley of the mountains. The Eternal my God shall come, and all the saints with him." Verse 5, notice the last part of verse 5. Notice verse 6, "It'll come to pass in that day, the light shall not be clear nor dark. It'll be one day that will be known to the Eternal, not day or night. And living waters in that day start going out from Jerusalem." Verse 9, "The Eternal is king over all the earth in that day. There's one Eternal and his name is one." Well, back to Isaiah 13. Now, by whom is all this going to happen to these
nations that make up Babylon.
Well, he's going to tell you now. Their children are going to be dealt with just like they did others' children. And there again, before you get angry at God and say, well, why would he ever do anything like that? Well, because their chances of salvation would be better if they're resurrected before they get calloused and hardened and have a 100-year millennial atmosphere to live in, instead of having to go on and live into the world with their training and ancestry of that day. So God does everything in love, whether if you understand God's full plan, then you can see that. But their children are going to be dashed to pieces, their houses spoiled, their wives ravished. Now notice who he's going to do it by. Behold, I'll stir up the Medes against them, which shall not regard silver and gold. In other words, other powers that maybe they could have bought off by giving them prosperity or wealth, but not these. They're not going to regard silver or gold. Now notice, you remember back in Daniel, when Nebuchadnezzar's empire fell and they had the handwriting on the wall, Daniel 5 and verse 28. And by the way, Daniel is one of the minor prophets, contrary to what the Jews think. Do you know the Jews don't even list the book of Daniel as a book of prophecy? Yet that's one of the most basic, important, significant books of prophecy there is. You get a Jewish Bible and look where they put it. They lump it under writings with Ruth and Esther. Not even listed as a book of prophecy. Well, what does that do to the Bible numerically? Well, you've got 12 minor prophets and 3 major prophets. A great number of 15, it means nothing. Well, what if you have Daniel in there with Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel? 16, 12 and 4, and boy, that's perfect again. And that's really the way it is. But anyway, in Daniel chapter 5, when Belshazzar of Babylon saw the handwriting on the wall, and God was showing him that that empire would be required of him that very night, look what he said. Instead of saying, many, many tekel upharsin, he didn't just say, your kingdom is weighed and found wanting and it's going to be brought down. He changed the last word on it and said, many tekel peres, which again is a numerical word, but it also means Persian. That's who's going to bring your empire down. Your kingdom is divided. This is Daniel 5, verse 28. Your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. And the Bible is so accurate, God puts Medes first because they were the first ones to come in, and Cyrus the Persian was the great king over that whole Media-Persian empire, but he went ahead and had Darius the Mede handle this area of government where his army has entered in. So God even named which one came there first, the Medes. Now, you can find the same thing back in Jeremiah 51, verse 11, where Jeremiah talked about the punishment of the Babylonian Empire. He says the same thing. Jeremiah 51, verse 1, Behold, I'll raise up against Babylon, and against them that dwell in the midst of them that rise up against me, a destroying wind. So old Babylon, back over there in the area where they had the desert winds blowing through the country. Now God likens the power that's going to bring them down to a destroying wind. And we'll send unto Babylon fanners that'll fan her and empty her land. Now, how's he going to do this? Well, read on. Verse 6, flee out of the midst of Babylon. And that's where John got his idea, about come out of her and don't be a partaker of her place. So he applied that to the end time system of all of the Babylonian government. But he got that out of Jeremiah here, where he's talking about fleeing out of the midst of that Babylon in that day before they were brought down. Deliver every man his soul. Apparently the Israelites were spared from that anyway. Notice, Babylon is gold, verse 7. Well, that's what it said in Daniel 2, the heads of gold. You wait, it's always referred to as the golden city, the golden cup, golden, in the New Testament and the Old. The golden empire is Babylon. Behold, a golden cup in the Eternal's hand that made all the earth drunken. All the nations of the earth have drunken of her wine, therefore the nations are mad. But all of a sudden, Babylon falls, just like John said in Revelation.
just like Daniel says that one night of Belshazzar, like Jeremiah says, like Isaiah says, we read it in Zechariah, everywhere. Babylon is fallen, suddenly, and destroyed. Well, how? Well, look at verse 11. Make bright the arrows, gather the shields. The Eternal has raised up the spirit of the kings of the Medes, for his device is against Babylon to destroy it, because it's the vengeance of the Eternal. So there again, notice how uniform and consistent and how the Bible parallels in those statements. So back to Isaiah 13. God says, I'll stir up the Medes against them. Bows shall dash the young men to pieces. They'll have no pity on the fruit of the womb. There I'll not spare children. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms. For some reason, the world's always marveled after this human Babylonian system, whether it was literal Babylon or the Roman Empire Babylon or whatever. The glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees, excellency, shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, that hadn't been that way before. God makes the point of that. The Arabian wouldn't take the tent there. You know, the old site of the original Babylon, you can't get nomads over there to go in and stay there. Now, you might have different human reasons as to why that would be that way. You know, one of the keys, some of the men wanted to get rid of our booklet on the proof of God, because they said Mr. Armstrong just kind of had some shallow follies about what God said about Tyre and Sidon and Ashkelon and those areas over there. And you get out an encyclopedia and you look up Tyre and Sidon, and it doesn't tell you what the Bible said their condition would be. You have to watch out, because there's a trick. And I learned that very well, because we were over in Israel, and we told our guide that we wanted to go to Ashkelon. The next thing we knew, here we were in this town, Ashkelon, Israel. Well, now that isn't what the Bible says. If you're part of the Bible, it doesn't mean any Ashkelon.
So I kind of scratched my head a minute. I said, well, you know, we want to go to the old Ashkelon. So he just took us to the slums of the same town. And then I said, well, wait a minute. Now I said, what about the Bible Ashkelon? And right away he got mad, got red-faced, started swearing. You know, his dad was a rabbi. But he was a tour guide, and he got angry because he said, you Americans, you know, you come over here and you don't even see the greatness of our country and all the things we've built in our modern world, and all you want to do is dabble back in the old Bible times. He's bellyached and drives all the way over there, you know. But 7 or 8 miles away, he took us to Ashkelon, and it was just like the Bible said it would be. Just the ruins there. I can show you the slides of it. It used to be a great city. In fact, it's the ideal place to have a city over there. Right on the peninsula jutting out into the blue Mediterranean, there was the scout group there, and they had a water well. But, you know, nobody lived there. But we saw where the old Roman towers used to live. We saw where the towers before them used to live. You know, God didn't say you can't build an Ashkelon, Arkansas. I mean, if you want to build Ashkelon, if you go back to the original Babylon where they were, and you can't get Arabians to pitch tents and dwell there. They think they're demons there. They're spooked by it. They think they're some kind of ghost or some kind of goblins that get you, like on Halloween night. So they won't stay there. Now, God didn't say they wouldn't stay 50 miles away in another part of the desert. You might want to name Babylon. So be careful somebody doesn't hoodwink you and try to make you think the Bible was inaccurate. Or inaccurate back at that time. Okay, coming back to it shall never be inhabited. Now, Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 3, we've read the first part of it. The word of the Eternal spake against Babylon, against the land of the Chaldees. Out of the north there comes up a nation against her, which will make her land desolate, and none shall dwell therein. They shall remove, they shall depart, both man and beast. So both Isaiah and Jeremiah said that. It'll never be inhabited, it won't be dwelt in. So the seat of the beast in the beginning of the millennium, as you remember in the book of Revelation, will be a burning cauldron there, because underneath the city of Rome, even now, are sulfur deposits and all kinds of rocks that are going to make a real hell at the first part of the millennium. So God's going to let people see what hell really is. And that's what they've been thinking it was all along. But when God pours out the plagues on Rome, the seat of the beast, the fire of that destruction is going to burn for a time into the millennium. Because God says the beauty of the Chaldeans' excellent fleet is going to be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, how has it been when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah? Well, fire from God came and devoured even the dirt. The deepest hole on earth is right where Sodom and Gomorrah used to be. We call it the Dead Sea. And one of the steepest rivers in the world dumps into a huge sea and then dies totally. And that's the way God says it's going to be when he overthrows Babylon. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. And how many generations? Well, God doesn't say. Is it going to last that way the whole millennium? I doubt if it will. Neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there, neither shall the shepherds make their fold there, but wild beasts of the desert shall lie there. And their houses shall be full of doleful creatures like the hyenas, and owls shall dwell there, and jackals are all kinds of weird animals. Now this word here, satyrs, is literally translated back in Leviticus, demons, devils. And maybe we ought to turn back there and read that term. Leviticus 17 and verse 7. Apparently God even foretold how the Arabians would be afraid to go there, because these spirits would occupy that area. Leviticus 17, verse 7, talking about cleansing the people by the priest, they'll no more offer their sacrifices unto devils. Now, that's not the normal word for devil or demon at all. This is the word that means shaggy goat, a kind of a weird word to translate devil or demon. The same word is in 2 Chronicles 11 and verse 15. I'm not going to turn and read those. In 2 Chronicles 25 and verse 14. But it shows that God actually forecast or foretold or prophesied that that area would be a hold of evil spirits. Some kind of spooky, ghosty devils like shaggy goats or wild shaggy creatures. And they'll dance there. That's an odd way of referring to shaggy demons or spirits dancing there. And the wild beasts of the islands shall cry in their desolate houses, and dragons or jackals in their pleasant palaces, and her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged. So that isn't too far off, God says, when that's going to be the condition of Babylon in our day, as it was back in the past. Now, coming on into chapter 14, for the Eternal will have mercy on Jacob, and will yet choose Israel, and set them in their own land. And the strangers shall be joined with them.
They had sojourners back in the days of the Exodus. The word set them here is not really very accurately translated, because it's the same word you read in other places, like verse 3, rest. So if the word literally says, God is going to make them rest. In other words, there's a millennium, the Sabbath rest, the thousand-year rest. I'd always circle that word rest in prophecy, because it's talking about the millennial rest, the Sabbath rest. So when God has mercy on Jacob and yet chooses Israel, when he sets them in there, or when he makes them rest, when he Sabbathizes them, that's not the word Shabbat, though, but it does mean make them rest in their own land. And the stranger shall be joined to them, and they'll cleave to the house of Jacob. And the people of Jacob are going to take these strangers and bring them to their place. And the house of Israel. Now, does that mean all 12 tribes, or does that mean just the 10? Well, he said he'd have mercy on Jacob. That name means all 12. So if he says, I'll have mercy on Jacob and yet choose Israel, he's talking about all 12 of them. All of them back together. So in that case, he's referring to the whole 12, the people,
of God's house of Israel bring these strangers that are wanting to unite themselves with Israel, and the house of Israel shall possess them in the land of the eternal for servants and handmaids. Those aren't words for slaves, though. They'll take them captives whose captives they were. So the same people that took Israel captive are now going to be captives to Israel until they're caught God's way, and you'll see what happens a little later. They're not permanent captives. But now they rule over their oppressors, and it'll come to pass in the day that the Eternal shall give you rest from your sorrow. In other words, in the millennial day, in the thousand-year day, the day the Eternal gives you rest from your sorrow and from your fears and from the hard bondage wherein you were made to serve, that you'll take up this proverb against the king of Babylon. And this begins the literal victory song, actually. The word proverb is rather a poor translation here because it's talking about a kind of a victory song pointing back, taunting, in a sense, the Eternal City and the Golden Empire, and now they're gone. Now they've been defeated and they're brought down. So it's kind of a taunting of them in that attitude. So here's the victory song against the king of Babylon. Quote, how has the oppressor ceased? The golden city, an exactress of gold, and one that was gold in the golden head. The Eternal has broken the staff of the wicked and the scepter of the rulers. And it's kind of interesting, this term, take up this proverb, is 12 times in the Bible, starting way back in Numbers even, and going into the minor prophets and even in the book of Job. So look how the whole Bible ties together when you see the numerical way that God uses terms. And that's just one of many that's that way. Back up in verse 2 where God says, the people of God shall take them and bring them to their own place. Even that four times here in this book of Isaiah. Coming on back to verse 4 anyway. You take up this victory song. The Eternal has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers. He who smote the people in wrath with a continual stroke, he that ruled the nations in anger, is persecuted, none hinders. So now when God brings down the Babylonian system totally, which includes even the Asiatic hordes and the overall Babylonian human government, now notice verse 7. The whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into singing. So there's the seventh of the thousand years God's Sabbath finally fulfilled. Yet the fir trees rejoice at you. And now God likens human governments again to different kinds of trees, as we've seen that he did in the past. The term break forth into singing also is used six times in Isaiah, and that just shows you know that's human, that's man. That's the way man does. It's a time of rest and quiet, he breaks forth into singing. That's human. It's the way a man does. So it's in the Isaiah 6 times. And now he talks about fir trees, and he's used that many times in Isaiah. Rejoice at you and the cedars of Lebanon. That just means the main government of man in the world. Since you're laid down, no fellers come up against us. In other words, now that Babylon has been put away, there are no more warriors, no more battles, no more cutting down human governments like cutting down trees. And now you get several different words for hell, and that's a unique chapter in that sense. It's kind of interesting. It's right in the same chapter with the devil's fall. He talks about hell, but he talks about three different kinds of hell here. Here in verse 9, hell from beneath is moved for you, to meet you at your coming. How does hell move from beneath to meet Christ at his coming? Well, it stirs up the dead for him. In other words, it's moved by the dead coming out of hell, being raised up and going up to meet Christ. Now, who are these dead that are stirred up that
come to meet Christ out of hell? Well, all the chief ones of the earth. The Hebrew word is leaders there, chief ones. Well, you know, guys like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and David, and all those rulers. The cunning rulers of all the earth stir hell by coming out of hell and moving up to meet Christ. Raised up from their thrones all the kings of the nations. All they speak and say unto you, are you also become weak as we, or you become like unto us? Now notice, though, he begins to talk to the human power of Babylon, and he's going to show you who the real government behind human government is. It's really the devil. So when the whole Babylonian system falls, who originated it anyway? Who's the god of it? Who's the power behind it? Remember how many times in Revelation the devil gives it its power? So when it talks about the coming fall of Babylon, he talks about Lucifer falling, because that's literally Lucifer's empires and Lucifer's system. So in verse 12, he zeroes in on the invisible spirit power behind this whole Babylonian system. How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, O day star, son of the morning? How are you cut down to the ground that did weaken the nation? So when he tried to ascend up and take over God's throne, as you know from Jude and other scriptures, he was cast back down. And then from that time on, what did he do? Well, he weakens the nation. And notice then, you said in your heart, I'll ascend into heaven. I'll exalt my throne. So he had a throne, but it was on the earth and not at somewhere else. So from the earth, you ascend into heaven. That's what he tried to do. So in his heart and his vanity, and you know, Paul warns us not to be lifted up with pride, or we'll fall into the condemnation of the devil. And I don't think most people realize the devil can get you through pride. And yet he's probably got more people out of the church in the last 10 years over ambition and pride and ego than he has any other way. But notice going on then, back, we might backtrack and fill in those verses we skipped over, but verse 10 shows that he's shifting gears instead of just talking to the literal physical empire of Babylon. Now he's beginning to look beyond the visible power of Babylon and show you who the real power behind Babylon is. Verse 10, all they shall speak and say to you, are you also become weak as we? What happened to this great eternal city, this great power that was promised to bring on a Christian millennium for all of mankind? Are you become like all of us other nations that went down, that fell, that have been defeated, that got wiped out in war? Your pomp brought down to the grave. And yet now, here's another word. Up above, he talks about hell in verse 9. That's the Greek word sheol, or Hebrew, excuse me, the Hebrew word sheol there. Now here in verse 11, this is, again, the word sheol here at first. The pomp is brought down to the sheol. The noise of your vials, the worm is spread under you. So here's where worms originated in sheol, immortal worms in hell. How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, morning star? So now he shifts to the invisible rulers and talks about Lucifer. You said in your heart, I'll ascend into the heavens and exalt my throne above the stars of God. And notice there symbolically, even in the Old Testament, stars are angels. Revelation 1 verse 20 says the stars are angels. Well, we already know that from Isaiah 14 and many other areas. So the devil tried to exalt his throne above other angels of God that weren't under his authority. He tried to sit on the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. And there again, that shows where God is. God's throne is up in the northern sky. There are many places that prove that, you know. There's one scripture that says promotion doesn't come from the east or the west or the south, and obviously leaves out where it does come from. The north, that's where God is. Psalm 48, verse 2. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the sides of the north. So even when God put Moriah
as the capital mound of Jerusalem, it's even on the north side, and that's where God's throne is in the north. And that's always the prominent direction, or the foremost direction. Now he says, I'll ascend above the heights of the clouds, back in Isaiah 14. I'll be like the Most High. Yet you'll be brought down. And here all of a sudden he doesn't use the word Sheol, because Satan the devil's not going to be brought down to a destruction. Satan the devil is going to be brought down to a... And here's the word, if you read it in the Greek, it'd be the word Tartarus. If you find a Greek translation of this particular passage, the sides of the pit. See, the word pit there is the Hebrew word is bor, which means a rock-hewn burying place. In other words, a cave. Somewhere in a cave, it doesn't mean just a hole in the ground like the word Sheol does. So when it talks about Satan, he's not going to be put in the same Sheol as far as destruction like man is going to be burnt up there. One thing we might take the time to do that back in Daniel, most people haven't noticed this, Daniel chapter 10. This shows what we are reading there, that invisibly behind human government, there are spirit powers. And different demons have their time and their power that they're in authority over. So if you get the story of Daniel 10, here's Daniel, verse 2, warning 21 days, 3 full weeks. He ate no pleasant bread, no flesh nor wine came into his mouth. He didn't anoint himself at all for those 3-4 weeks. Then on the 24th day of that first month, all of a sudden he looks and he begins to describe a supernatural being. And notice what he says then in verse 10. A hand touches Daniel and sets him on his knees. And he says, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words I speak to you. Stand upright, because to you I'm now sent. So when this spirit being had spoken that word to Daniel, he stood trembling. Then he said to Daniel, well, don't be terrified, Daniel. From the first day that you did set your heart to understand and to chasten yourself before your God, your words were heard. So he didn't have to fast 21 days before God heard him. From the very first day of those 21 days that he was fasting and chastening himself and setting his heart to understand what Jeremiah meant about 70 years, that's what he was fasting about. He couldn't figure out what Jeremiah had said about those 70 years. So he started fasting and asking God to let him see. So he set his heart to understand, but he was also chastening himself before his God. So from the very first of those days, God heard him, and this angel would come down and give him the message. But look what happened. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me. So all of a sudden, a real strong, powerful demonic spirit hindered this spirit being from God getting down. So for 21 days, this spirit angel of God was doing battle with this prince of the kingdom of Persia. So all of a sudden, God intervened and dispatched one more powerful, Michael. Well, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. And I remained there with those kings of Persia. Now I'm come to make you understand, and what will befall your people in the latter days. So you thought to understand. Now here, let me tell you what it was all, what the answer is. So his face was hard to the ground. He became dumb. Now he describes this supernatural spirit being. And then notice what happens. Verse 19. O man greatly beloved, don't be afraid. Peace be to you. Be strong. When he'd spoken to Daniel, Daniel was strengthened and said, let my Lord speak. Well, then he said, do you know whereof I'm come to you? But now I've got to return to fight with the prince of Persia. So here are these demonic powers using human government to try to thwart God and God's prophecy and God's plan. And so here are these invisible human leaders, or the human leaders being manipulated by these invisible spirit beings. And now God's angel's got to go back and bring down the Persian Empire and raise up the Grecian Empire, because that's what's prophesied. But these demonic powers try to make God out to be a liar. You know, they tried to wipe out the tribe of Judah during World War II. What would have happened if the demons had been able to use Hitler's power to wipe out all the Jews? God would be a liar. All the scriptures in the Bible about Judah would be lies. One day we'll find out how much Satan's powers have tried to make God out a liar. Why do you think there were peoples already in America when God had set it aside as the promised land for Manasseh? Why do you think there were powers already in Palestine when God already had decided that should be a set aside for Israel? That was the promised land. But Satan musters his powers to make God out a liar and get somebody else up there. Well, read on here. You know, this is scripture, really. This is the Bible. This is not some new weird blackle doctrine. Read and notice what he said. He said, "Do you know whereof I come to you? Now, after I've brought this revelation of Daniel 11, this longest prophecy in the Bible, you thought to understand by fasting 21 days? Now, I'm going to tell you." He told him the whole 11th chapter in chapter 12. But he said, "After I've told you all this, you thought to understand, I've got to go back and do battle with this prince of Persia. And when I'm gone forth, lo, the prince of Greece shall come. Then we'll bring down that Persian empire, and then this Grecian power will be allowed to take over. But I'll show you what is noted in the scripture of truth, and there's none that holds with me in these things but Michael, your prince." Now, the word "holds with" is weird there. It's not what it says in Hebrew. It says, "There's none that strengthens himself with me in these things except Michael." In other words, God had sent Michael down here to intervene and to get me through with this revelation to you, and then when I go back, he and I are going to have to bring down this prince of Persia. So notice chapter 11, "Also I," you know, the "I" is still the same "I" as verse 21. The same spirit being doing all the talking here. The same one that said, "I'll show you what's noted." "Also I," this same spirit being, "in the first year of Darius the Mede." How do you think Darius was able to take over the empire that God had decided he should rule? Well, we better get back to Isaiah. I don't want to get too far out of there. You can read in Revelation all about the unclean spirits like frogs coming out of that beast's mouth. You read all about the demon power that's going to be there in this coming Babylon. In fact, Mr. Armstrong said he believes that Hitler was Satan possessed. You know, at key times, the devil doesn't trust his own demons to do things. It says Satan entered into Judas, remember? Not a demon, just Satan. And Mr. Armstrong said he felt that's what happened to Hitler, too. Wasn't just a demon. That was a mighty important thing for him to try what he did through Hitler, so he did it himself. He didn't trust that to some demon. They'd bicker and fight and squabble and among themselves. Well, that's a different subject anyway, but he said, "I will be like the Most High. I'm going to ascend up above God," and you can read that again in chapter 47 and verse 8. And yet he said, "You're going to be brought down, but not to Sheol, to the same as Jude talked about the hell of the spirit being, Tartarus, to the sides of the pit." Now he goes back to the physical Babylon. After he's inserted those few verses about the invisible Satan, who really was the father of that Babylonian system, now he goes back to the human empire of Babylon, beginning in verse 16. "They that see you," you don't see Lucifer. That's not talking about Lucifer in verse 16. That's talking about the human power of Babylon. "They that see you shall narrowly look upon you and consider you, saying, is this the man?" See, that's not talking about Lucifer in verse 16. It's talking about Belshazzar or Nebuchadnezzar or whichever king that they're thinking about. "Is this the man that made the earth to tremble and did shake kingdoms, that made the world as a wilderness and destroyed the cities thereof?" So look what this coming beast and false prophet are going to have the power to do. Shake kingdoms, made the world as a wilderness,
destroyed the cities thereof, opened not the house of his prison. All the kings of the nations, even all of them lie in glory, every one in his own house. But you're cast out of your grave like an abominable branch. As in other words, here he is lying there desolate, burning for decades into the millennium. You're not even allowed to be buried like other empires that came down to the grave. You're cast out of your grave like an abominable branch, as the raiment of those that are slain, thrust through with the sword, that go down to the stones of the pit, as the carcass trodden under feet. So that's not just the word for a grave. You will not be joined with them in burial, because you've destroyed your land and slain your people. The seed of evildoers will never be renowned. In other words, how's God going to put an end to the great awe and reverence man has had for the Roman Empire and the Babylonian Empire? Well, they're not even going to be allowed to be buried with other empires that fall. They're going to be burning for decades into the millennium to show people what an abomination they've been. Because they've destroyed the earth and slain the people and the seed of evildoers, God wouldn't dare just make martyrs out of them or let them be treated like other nations. They're never going to be renowned. Prepare slaughter for his children, for the iniquity of their fathers, that they do not rise, nor possess the land, nor fill the face of the world with cities. So for a while, the Babylonians are not going to be allowed to be back as a nation again. For I'll raise up against them, says the Eternal of Hosts, and cut off from Babylon the name and remnant and son and grandson, as Lord nephew should be there, says the Eternal. So at least for a couple of generations, it's going to be cut off as far as being a world government. I'll make it a possession for the bittern and pools of water. That's a swamp land with a bunch of swamp birds in it. I'll sweep it with the beacon of destruction, says the Eternal of Hosts. Now the Eternal of Hosts has sworn, saying, surely, as I fought, so it'll come to pass. And as I purposed, so it'll stand. And now all of a sudden, notice, so far he's been talking about Babylon, the king of Babylon. He's been talking about the excellency of the Chaldeans, the beauty of the Chaldeans' excellency. And now all of a sudden he starts talking about Assyria. Where would anybody ever think Assyria is the last phase of the Babylonian system? Why would anybody think Assyria is the last power that's going to resurrect that old Roman Empire? Well, boy, it tells you right there, as well as many other places. The Eternal of Hosts has sworn, saying, surely as I fought, it'll come to pass, I'll break the Assyrian in my land. Armageddon, Palestine, Megiddo, that's where, gathering them all together at Jerusalem. I'll break the Assyrian in my land and upon my mountains. You notice what God's land is? It's not just one country, it's a number of countries. Upon my mountains and tread him underfoot, then his yoke shall depart from off them and his burden depart from off their shoulders. This is the purpose, that purpose upon the whole earth. This is the hand that's stretched out upon all the nations. So when God brings the Assyrian down and breaks him, it's something that's going to involve the whole earth, and it's something that's going to involve all the nations. For the Eternal Host has purposed, and who will disannul it? His hand is stretched out, who will turn it back? In the year that King Ahaz, now see, comes all of a sudden back to the historical, physical times of that literal day of Isaiah. In the year that King Ahaz died was this burden. But you can't read all that into history. There's so many things in there that you can't just read into history. Talking about an end time fulfillment. So now he starts talking about the other nations around Israel and Judah, and says, don't you rejoice, you whole Philistia. A terrible mistranslation there. It's not Palestine. You don't find that word there at all. The word is Philistia. Talking about the whole area that used to be the territory of the Philistines, or all of those countries surrounding Judah. So when they fell, the peoples all around them rejoiced.
because Ahaz died. Because the rod of him that smote you is broken, don't you rejoice because Ahaz's rod is broken. Because out of Ahaz's root, out of the serpent's root, shall come forth the cockatrice, Hezekiah. You think you had trouble with Ahaz, you wait till you get dealt with by his son. You haven't had anything. You've just had a serpent. So far, now you're going to have a cockatrice. And his fruit's going to be a fiery, flying serpent. Now, if you think you've had trouble with Ahaz, you wait till Hezekiah gets through with you. You're going to be involved with a fiery, flying serpent. And the firstborn of the poor shall feed, and the needy shall lie down in safety. I'll kill your root with famine, and he'll slay your remnant. So here he's talking to all the areas around them referred to as Philistia, and what he was going to do by Hezekiah. Killing the root of these surrounding Philistias with famine, and then Hezekiah slaying their remnant. Hallow gate, trial city, you hold Philistia, are dissolved. There's going to come from the north a smoke, and none's going to be alone in his appointed time. What will one then answer the messengers of the nations? That the Eternal has founded Zion, and the poor of his people shall trust in it. Now, a couple of those scriptures are dual, referring to the millennium as well. What's going to be an answer that God gives to all messengers of nations when he intervenes? Well, verse 32 is talking about the millennium. That the Eternal has founded Zion, but did he do that when he intervened and helped Hezekiah? Well, yeah, he did, humanly, physically, as a type. But is that the whole fulfillment of verse 32? I don't think it is. That the Eternal has founded Zion, and the poor of his people shall trust in it. Okay, now he comes to the burden of Moab. And I'll just express my ignorance here because I'm not too sure who I believe Moab is. You know, when you take the Bible terminology, you don't have much choice because it talks about Ammon, and of course that's the capital of Jordan and it's always been their name. So he tells you about Egypt. So he tells you about Ethiopia. We've read about Arabia. You can read about Damascus and Syria. You can read about the cedars of Lebanon. Who's that leave you? Well, that leaves you Iraq and Iran, that's all. Well, one of those isn't that much Arab. You know, you've got all the other countries in the Middle East nailed down by the Bible. It tells you who Edom is, Turkey. It tells you all about any of the other countries around there. And then all of a sudden you got the name Moab just kind of hanging out here in the uncertainty as far as I'm concerned. Maybe it isn't. Maybe it's just Iraq. But you know, the way things were going for a while, I thought, well, hey, maybe Moab's Iran. And I'm not too sure yet which one it is. Maybe it is Iraq. Maybe that's the kind of a thing you just have to kind of wait and see or watch and see. But anyway, it's interesting when you take a lot of the terminology about Moab and apply it to the end time and what's going on between Iraq and Iran. Boy, oh boy, it's funny how many things that happened it tells you about. Well, either way, let's just wait and see. The burden of Moab. Because in the night, Ar of Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. Because in the night, Kir of Moab is laid waste. These are just cities brought to silence. He's gone up to Baajus, to Dibon. Those are cities as well, high places to weep. Moab shall howl over Nebo. That was their pride and joy and their high place. And over Medeba, on all their heads shall be baldness, every beard cut off. Well, who wears beards? And to whom is it a curse to cut off their beard? And to whom would it be a curse to be bald and not have a beard? Well, God says that's what they're going to do. They're going to be so burdened with the threats of the powers that are going to bring them smashing down that's laid waste their major cities. Is that going to happen to Iran or Iraq? Well, I'm not sure which. It may happen to Iraq. Well, who's going to do it to them? Well, so far the Russians standing on the other side. And the Muslims, the Arabs, are pretty much divided as to which one of those countries they're going to support. But according to
Isaiah 15, I know their cities are going to be laid waste. I just don't know who's going to do it. And I also know that they're going to howl and weep and have baldness and their beards all cut off. I know in their streets they're going to gird themselves with sackcloth on the top of their houses. And I know that in their streets everyone's going to howl and weep abundantly. I know that Heshbon's going to cry, and Eliela, their voice is going to be heard all the way to the borders of the country, Jahaz. Therefore, the armed soldiers of Moab shall cry out. That's kind of interesting. The term armed soldiers here in the Hebrew just means light armed troopers. They don't have heavy equipment. They don't have everything that is described in Bible terminology as war power. But these armed soldiers of Moab are going to cry out, his life shall be grievous to him. The horrors of war, the horrors of what's going to happen to them in war. My heart's going to cry out for Moab. His fugitives are going to flee to Zoar, a heifer 3 years old. In other words, it's like a straggler going out lost from a herd. Fugitives are going to wander. For by the mounting up of Luhith with weeping shall they go it up, for in the way of Heronaim they shall raise up a cry of destruction. For the waters of Nimrim shall be desolate. Is that from atomic devastation, or just from drought, or what? The hay is withered away, the grass fails, there's no green thing. Therefore, the abundance they've gotten and that which they've laid up, is that talking about Iran or Iraq? The abundance they've gotten, that which they've laid up, is going to be carried away to the brook of the willows. The cry has gone round about the borders of Moab, the howling thereof into Eglaim, and the howling thereof into Beer Elam. You know, when the student sprang on me the idea that you take a little wine for your stomach's sake, and I said, well, I don't know if my stomach needs any. I hadn't had any belly aches. And I said, well, you know, it says take it for your often infirmities. And I said, well, I hadn't had any often infirmities either. You know, I didn't say drink wine socially. I didn't read it that way. That's when I first started, and I found out later it did. So for the first year or two, I wouldn't drink any beer. It didn't say take a little beer for your stomach's sake. So I wasn't going to drink beer. It said wine, all right. Then I found out the word for well in the Hebrew is the word beer. So it couldn't very well be prohibited. It's the very word well. So you just, you know, when you read the word, the well of Laharoi, or beer, Laharoi, that means well, the well of Laharoi. It's literally the word beer, where we get our word beer. Well, anyway, what's that got to do with it? With Isaiah. Well, it doesn't cost anything extra anyway. The waters of diamonds shall be full of blood. I'm going to bring more on diamonds, lions upon him that escapes of Moab and upon the remnant of the land. Send you the lamb to the ruler of the land. Boy, all of a sudden, you've got something different here. Send you the lamb to the ruler of the land from Petra. Yeah, that's right. That's what the word Selah is here, Petra. Boy, can you imagine that, sending the lamb from Petra to the ruler of the land? Well, what ruler of what land? Well, so far, the only one we've been reading about is Moab. And now, all of a sudden, it says the lamb is to be sent from Petra to the ruler of Moab. Well, I wonder what that's going to be all about. Well, he's going to tell you. To the wilderness, to the mount of the daughter of Zion. Now, you notice then, the daughter of Zion is here at this time that the lamb is sent to the ruler of the land. And where is this daughter of Zion? Well, they're in the wilderness. But they're still together as a mount. For it shall be as a wandering bird cast out of the nest. The daughters of Moab shall be at the fords of Arnon. Well, now he's been talking about the daughter of Zion in verse 1, and now he says the daughter of Zion is like a bird cast out of the nest, and yet he says we're there at the fords of Arnon, and also the daughters of Moab are there at the fords of Arnon. Well, what he's leading up to here anyway? Well, he says, What does this leader that goes up to their leader do? Well, he takes counsel. He executes judgment. Make your shadow of the night in the midst of the noonday. Hide the outcast. Uh-oh. You mean to tell me the lamb going to the ruler, talking about the daughter of Zion, to the daughters of Moab, says, hide the outcast. Well, I'm pretty ignorant. I've just got Peter written right across those verses there. Now, that may not be the exact place, but it's certainly a type of what's going to happen to the outcasts of God. Of course, Peter just happens to be in that land also. Take counsel, execute judgment. Make your shadow of the night in the midst of the noonday. In other words, this leader's asking their leaders to execute judgment, to be just and fair, and to put a shadow over these outcasts. Bewray not him that wanders. In other words, don't give him away. Don't turn him over to all these enemies about. So here's one leader of a country that's going to be asked to not turn over these outcasts. And now notice plainly what he says in verse 4. Let mine outcast dwell with thee, Moab. So if you had any question what he's saying up until now, he just comes right out and lays it on the line there. That's pretty blank and frank and blunt. Let mine outcast dwell with thee, Moab. Be you a covert to them from the face of the spoilers. In other words, hide them when the spoiler's out after them. You be a shadow of protection. For the extortioner is at an end. In other words, old Babylon that went about to take the wealth from all the other powers, the extortioner, Babylon, is having their downfall now, and God's saying, protect those outcasts. The spoiler ceases, the oppressors are consumed out of the land, and in mercy shall the throne be established. All of all sudden, it's talking about the lamb, and now it talks about the throne being established in mercy. You know another weird thing? This is the King James translation in your lap there, but Protestants like to have you believe there wasn't any grace in the Old Testament. You ever look up the word mercy? Half the times it's a Hebrew word grace. You think they didn't have grace in the Old Testament? Oh, they had grace, grace, grace galore back there. Moses had grace, and Abraham had grace, and Isaac had grace, and Jacob had grace, and David had grace. We all know David had grace. The Protestants don't want you to think there was a grace. See, that's a dispensation of law. But boy, we in the New Testament, we're in that dispensation of grace, and our halos just light up, you know. And well, that's ridiculous. They had grace back there. The throne's going to be established in grace. He's going to sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David. Now, you can't have any question who he's talking about there. The Messiah, the Christ, in mercy. His throne being established. Christ sitting on it in truth in the tabernacle of David. Judging and seeking judgment and hasting righteousness. But now all of a sudden, right in the middle of two different segments about Moab, he has all this about the lamb going to the leader and hiding the outcast and all about Christ sitting on the throne of David. Now he comes back to where we were in chapter 15 and says, we've heard of the pride of Moab. He's very proud. Well, does that depict Iraq or Iran, or who does that depict? Well, maybe either one of them later. We've heard of the pride. You know, Iran was the one that had the greatest military might among all the Arabs, but what's happened to it? Well, you run up against the Russians, you know, and you play second fiddle in a hurry. We've heard of the pride of Moab. He's very proud, even of his haughtiness and his pride and his wrath. But his lies are not going to be so. In other words, all these falsehoods of pretensions of being a mighty power and having great weaponry and great strength and great unity and all of those lies that he fosters off on people with his pride, trying to make them think he's really somebody great, all of those lies are going to be exposed as being lies. Therefore, Moab is going to howl for Moab. Everyone's going to howl. For the foundations are going to be, are you going to mourn? They're going to be stricken. The fields are going to languish, the vines. The lords of the heathen have broken down the principal plants thereof,
Now you see what happens to Moab? The lords of the heathen. I wonder who that is. Is that talking about Asiatic hordes? Is that talking about the United States of Europe? The lords of the heathen are going to bring down the principal plants of Moab. They are come even to Jazer. They wandered through the wilderness. Her branches are stretched out. They're gone over the sea. Therefore, I'll bewail with the weeping of Jazer, the vine. I'll water you with my tears, O Heshbon and Elealeh, for the shouting, for your summer fruits and your harvest has fallen. So is drought going ahead, or is it just going to be devastation from the lords of the heathen? Gladness is taken away. Joy out of the plentiful field. Well, what would you describe that way? The plentiful field. In the vineyards, there will be no singing. Neither shall there be shouting. The treaders are going to tread out no wine in their presses. I've made their vintage shouting to cease. Wherefore my bowel shall sound like an harp for Moab. Mine inward parts for Kaharish. It'll come to pass when it's seen Moab is weary on the high place. He'll come to his sanctuary to pray, but he'll not prevail. In other words, his God isn't going to get him out of this one. This is the word that the Eternal has spoken concerning Moab since that time. But now the Eternal has spoken, saying, within 3 years after the death of Ahaz, that's the only time period you've had zeroed in so far. So within 3 years after Ahaz's death, as the years of a hireling, the glory of Moab is going to be contemned with all that great multitude. In other words, the Asiatic hordes are going to put an end to Moab, the Russians, and the Chinese, and the Japanese. Well, I wonder if that's Iraq or Iran. Well, it can't be anybody else. It has to be one of them. And yet I know what's going to happen to them. The lords of the heathen are going to break them down. All that great multitude is going to be, they're going to be condemned, the glory of Moab, by that great multitude. And the remnant shall be very small and feeble. So there's only going to be a small remnant left of Moab to start a new Moab in the millennium. Now he goes from there to Syria. The burden of Damascus. Behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city and it'll be a ruinous heap. Well, is that so? Has that happened already? Or is that something yet in the future? The cities of Aroer are forsaken. Well, is that true? You look that up in the Bible Atlas and see where those cities were and see if they're forsaken. And if they aren't, then that's not happened yet. But they are going to be in the future forsaken, and they're going to be for flocks, which shall lie down, and none shall make them afraid. So instead of cities scattering over this territory of Aroer, they're just going to be grazing animals. The fortress also shall cease from Ephraim. Now here you go back to the physical where Ephraim was allied with Syria against Judah, and remember the history. So now he's talking about the fortress also from Ephraim is going to cease, and the kingdom from Damascus, and then the remnant of Syria, they're going to be as the glory of the children of Israel, says the Eternal Host. Now, what's the remnant of Syria? Well, those are the ones that are still left after it's punished. After it's dealt with, and like Moab, a very small and feeble element left. Syria will have a larger amount left because they're not described very small and feeble. But in the end, the last peoples that are left in the nation of Damascus, Syria, are going to be converted. Notice what that says. The remnant of Syria, they shall be as the glory of the children of Israel. In other words, they're going to come to know God and be converted and live God's way and be under God's government and be just like the glory of the children of Israel, says the Eternal Host. And in that day, sure enough, you'd expect that phrase because that nails it down right away when he's talking about. So, you know, one of the real keys of prophecy is letting the Bible itself show you when a verse moves from the physical antitype of the historical setting down to an end time duality. And there's a dead giveaway, a good example right here. In that day, it'll come to pass, the glory of Jacob, which is now going to come on the remnant of Assyria, but now the glory of Jacob is going to have to be made thin, the fatness of his flesh is going to have to wax lame. So now he talks about Jacob's time of punishment and scarcity and captivity, and it'll be as when the harvestman gathers the corn and reaps the ears with his arm. In other words, you can harvest the whole field in one arm. It'll be as he that gathers ears in the valley of Rephaim, one of the giants. Yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it, as the shaking of an olive tree, two or three berries in the top of the uppermost bough. That's not the normal way you leave gleaning. That shows the scarcity. Four or five in the outmost fruitful branches thereof, says the eternal God of Israel. Now notice, he says, in that day, in verse 4. Now verse 7, he says, at that day, a man shall look to his maker. So finally, Israel's going to wake up in their punishment and scarcity, and then they're going to look to their maker, and his eyes are going to have respect to the Holy One of Israel. He'll not look to the altars, the works of his hands, neither shall respect what his fingers have made, either the Asherah or the images. Now, of course, here's talking about the Easter practices, the grove, the Asherah, and the sun images, as the latter word is. They're talking about Baal and Easter that they've gone into in their paganism. And those are the altars Israel made to themselves, the work of their own hands, Christmas, Easter, Halloween, all that. In that day shall his strong cities be as a forsaken bough and an uppermost branch. So now God likens the scarcity of physical harvest to the scarcity of the peoples of Israel left, only a tithe of them left. So his strong cities are going to be like that forsaken bough, two or three berries in the top of it, an uppermost branch they left because of the children of Israel, and there will be desolation. Because you've forgotten the God of your salvation, and you haven't been mindful of the rock of your strength. Therefore, you're going to plant pleasant plants and set it with strange slips. In other words, it's never going to produce like it should have and did in the past. In the day shall you make your plant to grow, and in the morning shall you make your seed to flourish, but the harvest shall be a heap in the day of grief and of desperate sorrow. And now he comes back, woe to the multitude of many people, which make a noise like the noise of the seas. Now he comes back to where we were reading earlier about all the nations gathered together at Armageddon. That makes the rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. The nations shall rush like the rushing of many waters. But God will rebuke them, and they're going to flee far off. They're going to be chased like the chaff of the mountains before the wind, like a rolling thing before the whirlwind. God's going to chase away all these at Armageddon, trying to annihilate human life. Behold, at evening time, trouble, before the morning, all of a sudden they're all gone. It's all going to be in one day, in other words. So here they are all gathered together at evening time as if the final destruction of man is going to be there, and then all of a sudden, by the next morning, none of them are there anymore. So that's going to be the portion of the nations that spoil Israel and the lot of those that rob God's people. Now in chapter 18, he says, woe to the land shadowing with wings. That's the same as what he said back here in verse 12. Woe to the multitude of many people. But now he comes back to one land specifically. And this chapter is a unique chapter because God doesn't really let you know who all he's talking about here. So as a good lesson in how to understand the Bible, let's just see how we figure out who this is in chapter 18. The land shadowing with wings. Beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. Okay, now that's quite a giveaway. If somebody's south in Africa or west in Africa, beyond Ethiopia. So, who is that? Well, let's read what he says about them. That sends ambassadors by the sea, even in vessels of bulrushes upon the waters. Go, you swift messengers, to a nation scattered in peels, to a people terrible from their beginning hitherto, a nation meted out and trodden down, whose land the rivers have spoiled, Well, where are they sending these messengers? Who is this nation scattered and peeled? Who is this people terrible from their beginning hitherto? Who's this nation meted out and trodden down, whose land the rivers have spoiled? Well, is that Egypt? Is that what he's talking about? All those seven branches of the Nile going on up to the Red Sea, or the Mediterranean, I mean. All you inhabitants of the world and dwellers on the earth see you when he lifted up an ensign on the mountains and when he blows the trumpet. Now, there's the dead giveaway of when it is. It's at the time of the seventh trumpet when God intervenes and sets up an ensign on the nations, a ruler, a Christ, the Messiah. So the message is to all the inhabitants of the world, to all the dwellers on the earth, when God lifts up his Son as the King of kings and Lord of lords on the mountains with that blowing of that seventh trumpet, then all nations on earth are going to hear. And even this nation we're reading about, whoever it is then going to send ambassadors. And of course, it's talking about the people of Israel that have been scattered and peeled, the people of Judah, and this power beyond the rivers of Ethiopia is going to send ambassadors up there to Palestine, to Judea, to Israel. And it's at the time when Christ comes back. So they're going to say, come, let's go up the mountain of God, and he'll teach us his ways. And now read on and notice. For so the Eternal said to me, I'll take my rest. Right away there again is the millennium. I'll take my Sabbath. It's time for my 1,000-year Sabbath. I'm going to take my Sabbath, and I'm going to consider in my dwelling place. Where's that? Well, that's Zion. That's Israel, Judah. I'll consider in my dwelling place, like a clear heat upon herbs, like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. For before the harvest, when the bud is perfect, and the sour grapes ripening in the flower, he'll both cut off the sprigs with pruning hooks and take away and cut down the branches. They'll be left together to the fowls of the mountains, to the beasts of the earth. So now it's talking about someone that's been punished and destroyed. In verse 5 and 6, they'll be left together to the fowls of the mountains, to the beasts of the earth. The fowls shall summer on them, and all the beasts of the earth shall winter on them. In that time shall the present be brought unto the Eternal of Hosts. Okay, now you get back to the description in verse 3 where Christ is returned and he's setting up world government and the millennium rest in his dwelling place. And now this land beyond the rivers of Ethiopia is sending ambassadors up there. And now all of a sudden, look who this people peeled and scattered is. They're the people of Israel. Because Lotus verse 7, shall the present be brought unto the Eternal of Hosts of the people scattered and peeled. So that's the present. These people are brought back to God, to God's country, to God's territory that he set apart from them, or for them. And now these people that were scattered and peeled, that people that were a people terrible from their beginning, a nation that was meted out and trodden underfoot, that the rivers had spoiled, to the place of the name of the Eternal of Hosts, the Mount of Zion. So now they're brought to God as an offering, a present. Now, some people read that saying that this is talking about some of the countries south of Ethiopia, and that they're the presents given to God in the millennium. They're the people that got scattered and peeled by the beast power, and now they're given back to God as subject to him during this millennium. Now, that might be, but when you read about the messengers going up in verse 2, it sounds more like he's talking about Israel being brought back.